Bud embarks on a life of crime, an insult to a tribe and its consequences. Bud rolled his first victim almost by accident. He'd taken a wrong turn into a cul-de-sac and inadvertently trapped a black man and woman and a couple of little kids who'd blundered in there before him. They had a scared look about them, like a lot of the new arrivals did, and Bud noticed the way the man's gaze lingered on his sights, wondering whether those crosshairs, invisible to him, were centered on him, his lady, or his kid. Bud didn't get out of their way. He was packing, they weren't, it was up to them to get out of his way. But instead, they just froze up.
"You got a problem?" Bud said.
"What do you want?" the man said.
It had been a while since anyone had manifested such sincere concern for Bud's desires, and he kind of liked it. He realized that these people were under the impression that they were being mugged.
"Oh, same as anyone else. Money and shit," Bud said.
And just like that, the man took some hard yukus out of his pocket and handed them over, and then actually thanked him as he backed away. Bud enjoyed getting that kind of respect from black people. It reminded him of his noble heritage in the trailer parks of North Florida, and he didn't mind the money either. After that day, he began looking for black people with that same scared, uncertain look about them. These people bought and sold off the record, and so they carried hard money. He did pretty well for himself for a couple of months. Every so often he would stop by the flat where his bitch Tequila lived, give her some lingerie, and maybe give Harve some chocolate. Harve was presumed by both Bud and Tequila to be Bud's son. He was 5, which meant that he had been conceived in a much earlier cycle of Bud and Tequila's breakup and makeup relationship. Now the bitch was pregnant again, which meant that Bud would have to bring even more gifts to her place when he came around. The pressures of fatherhood. One day, Bud targeted a particularly well-dressed family because of their fancy clothes. The man was wearing a business suit, and the woman a nice, clean dress, and they were carrying a baby all dressed up in a white lacy thing, and they had hired a porter to help them haul their luggage away from the aerodrome. The porter was a white guy who vaguely reminded Bud of himself, and he was incensed to see him acting as a pack animal for blacks. So as soon as these people got away from the bustle of the aerodrome and into a more secluded neighborhood, Bud approached them, swaggering in the way he'd practiced in the mirror, occasionally pushing his sights up on his nose with one index finger. The guy in the suit was different from most of them. He didn't try to act like he hadn't seen Bud, didn't try to skulk away, didn't cringe or slouch. Just stood his ground, feet planted squarely, and very pleasantly said,
"Yes, sir. Can I be of assistance?"
He didn't talk like an American black. He had almost a British accent, but crisper. Now that Bud had come closer, he saw that the man had a strip of colored cloth thrown around his neck and over his lapels, dangling down like a scarf. He looked well-housed and well-fed for the most part, except for a little scar high up on one cheekbone. Bud kept walking until he was a little too close to the guy. He kept his head tilted back until the last minute, like he was kicking back listening to some loud tunes, which he was, and then suddenly snapped his head forward so he was staring the guy right in the face. It was another way to emphasize the fact that he was packing, and it usually did the trick. But this guy did not respond with the little flinch that Bud had come to expect and enjoy. Maybe he was from some booga-booga country where they didn't know about skull guns.
"Sir," the man said, "my family and I are on our way to our hotel. We have had a long journey and we are tired. My daughter has an ear infection. If you would state your business as expeditiously as possible, I would be obliged."
"You talk like a fucking Vicky," Bud said.
"Sir, I am not what you refer to as a Vicky, or I should have gone directly there. I would be obliged if you could be so kind as to moderate your language in the presence of my wife and child."
It took Bud a while to untangle this sentence, and a while longer to believe that the man really cared about a few dirty words spoken within earshot of his family, and longer yet to believe that he had been so insolent to Bud, a heavily muscled guy who was obviously packing a skull gun.
"I'm going to fucking say whatever I fucking want to your bitch and your fucking brat," Bud said very loud. Then he could not keep himself from grinning. "Score a few points for Bud."
The man looked impatient rather than scared and heaved a deep sigh.
"Is this an armed robbery or something? Are you sure you know what you're getting into?"
Bud answered by whispering "hut" under his breath and firing a crippler into the man's right bicep.
It went off deep in the muscle, like an M-80, blowing a dark hole in the sleeve of the man's jacket and leaving his arm stretched out nice and straight. The trike now pulling without anything to oppose it. The man clenched his teeth, his eyes bulged, and for a few moments he made strangled grunting noises from way down in his chest, making an effort not to cry out. Bud stared at the wound in fascination. It was just like shooting people in a reactive. Except that the bitch didn't scream and beg for mercy. She just turned her back, using her body to shield the baby, and looked over her shoulder, calmly, at Bud. Bud noticed she had a little scar on her cheek, too.
"Next I take your eye," Bud said. "Then I go to work on the bitch."
The man held up his good hand, palm out, indicating surrender. He emptied his pocket of hard universal currency units and handed them over. And then Bud made himself scarce because the monitors, almond-sized aerostats with eyes, ears, and radios, had probably picked up the sound of the explosion and begun converging on the area. He saw one hiss by him as he rounded the corner, trailing a short whip antenna that caught the light like a hairline crack in the atmosphere. 3 days later, Bud was hanging around the aerodrome looking for easy pickings when a big ship came in from Singapore. Immersed in a stream of 2,000 arrivals was a tight group of some 24 solidly built, very dark-skinned black men dressed in business suits, with strips of colored cloth draped around their necks and little scars on their cheekbones. It was later that night that Bud, for the first time in his life, heard the word Ashanti.
"Another 25 Ashanti just came in from L.A.," said a man in a bar.
"The Ashanti had a big meeting in the conference room at the Sheraton," said a woman on the street.
Waiting in a queue for one of the free matter compilers, a bum said,
"One of them Ashanti gave me 5 yooks. They're fine folks."
When Bud ran into a guy he knew, a former comrade in the decoy trade, he said,
"Hey, the place is crawling with them Ashanti, ain't it?"
"Yep," said the guy, who had seemed unaccountably shocked to see Bud's face on the street, and who was annoyingly distracted all of a sudden, swiveling his head to look all ways.
"They must be having a convention or something," Bud theorized. "I rolled one of them the other night."
"Yeah, I know," his friend said.
"Huh? How'd you know that?" "They ain't having a convention, Bud. All of those Ashanti, except the first one, came to town hunting for you."
Paralysis struck Bud's vocal cords, and he felt lightheaded, unable to concentrate.
"I gotta go," his friend said,
and removed himself from Bud's vicinity. For the next few hours, Bud felt as though everyone on the street was looking at him. Bud was certainly looking at them, looking for those suits, those colored strips of cloth. But he caught sight of a man in shorts and a T-shirt, a black man, with very high cheeks, one of which was marked with a tiny scar, and almost Asian-looking eyes in a very high state of alertness. So he couldn't rely on the Ashanti wearing stereotyped clothing. Very soon after that, Bud swapped clothes with an indigent, down on the beach, giving up all his black leather and coming away with a T-shirt and shorts of his own. The T-shirt was much too small. It bound him under the armpits and pressed against his muscles so that he felt the eternal twitching even more than usual. He wished he could turn the stimulators off now, relax his muscles even for one night, but that would require a trip to the mod parlor, and he had to figure that the Ashanti had the mod parlors all staked out. He could have gone to any of several brothels, but he didn't know what kind of connections these Ashanti might have, or even what the hell an Ashanti was exactly, and he wasn't sure he could get a boner under these circumstances anyway. As he wandered the streets of the leased territories, primed to level his sights at any black person who blundered into his path, he reflected on the unfairness of his fate. How was he to know that guy belonged to a tribe? Actually, he should have known, just from the fact that he wore nice clothes and didn't look like all the other people. The very apartness of those people should have been a dead giveaway, and his lack of fear should have told him something, like he couldn't believe anyone would be stupid enough to mug him. Well, Bud had been that stupid, and Bud didn't have a file of his own, so Bud was screwed. Bud would have to go get himself one real quick, now. He'd already tried to join the Boers a few years back. The Boers were, to Bud's kind of white trash, what these Ashanti were to most of the blacks. Stocky blondes in suits or the most conservative sorts of dresses, usually with half a dozen kids in tow, and my God, did they ever stick together. Bud had paid a few visits to the local lager, studied some of their training reactives on his home Mediatron, put in some extra hours at the gym trying to meet their physical standards, even gone to a couple of horrific Bible study sessions. But in the end, Bud and the Boers weren't much of a match. The amount of church you had to attend was staggering. It was like living in church. And he'd studied their history. But there were only so many Boer-Zulu skirmishes he could stand to read about or keep straight in his head. So that was out. He wasn't getting into any lager tonight. The Vickies wouldn't take him in a million years, of course. Almost all the other tribes were racially oriented, like those Parsis or whatever. The Jews wouldn't take him unless he cut a piece of his dick off and learned to read a whole nother language, which was a bit of a tall order since he hadn't gotten round to learning how to read English yet. There were a bunch of Cenobitical files, religious tribes that took people of all races, but most of them weren't very powerful and didn't have turf in the leased territories. The Mormons had turf and were very powerful, but he wasn't sure if they'd take him as quickly and readily as he needed to be taken. Then there were the tribes that people just made up out of thin air, the synthetic files. But most of them were based on some shared skill or weird idea or ritual that he wouldn't be able to pick up in half an hour. Finally, sometime around midnight, he wandered past a man in a funny gray jacket and cap with a red star on it, trying to give away little red books, and it hit him. Sendero. Most Senderistas were either Incan or Korean, but they take anyone. They had a nice clave here in the leased territories, a clave with good security, and every one of them down to the last man or woman was batshit. They'd be more than a match for a few dozen Ashantis. And you could join any time just by walking in the gates. They would take anyone, no questions asked. He'd heard it was not such a good thing to be a communist, but under the circumstances he figured he could hold his nose and quote from the little red book as necessary. As soon as those Ashantis left town, he'd bolt. Once he'd made up his mind, he couldn't wait to get there. He had to restrain himself from breaking into a jog, which would be sure to draw the attention of any Ashantis on the street. He couldn't bear the idea of being so close to safety and then blowing it. He rounded a corner and saw the wall of the Sendero clay 4 stories high and 2 blocks long, one solid giant mediatron with a tiny gate in the middle. Mao was on one end, waving to an unseen multitude, backed up by his horse-toothed wife, and his beetle-browed sidekick Lin Bao and Chairman Gonzalo was on the other, teaching some small children. And in the middle was a slogan in 10-meter-high letters, "Strive to uphold the principles of Mao Gonzalo thought." The gate was guarded, as always, by a couple of 12-year-old kids in red neckerchiefs and armbands, ancient bolt-action rifles with real bayonets leaning against their collarbones, a blonde-white girl and a pudgy Asian boy. Bud and his son Harv had whiled away many an idle hour trying to get these kids to laugh, making silly faces, mooning them, telling jokes. Nothing ever worked. But he'd seen the ritual. They'd bar his path with crossed rifles and not let him in until he swore his undying allegiance to Mao Gonzalo thought, and then a horse or something built around the same general plan was coming down the street at a hand gallop. Its hooves did not make the pocking noise of iron horseshoes. Bud realized it was a chevaline, a 4-legged robot thingy. The man on the chev was an African in very colorful clothing. Bud recognized the patterns on that cloth and knew without bothering to check for the scar that the guy was Ashanti. As soon as he caught Bud's eye, he kicked it up another gear to a tantivy. He was going to cut Bud off before he could reach Sendero, and he was too far away yet to be reached by the skull gun, whose infinitesimal bullets had a disappointingly short range. He heard a soft noise behind him and swiveled his head around, and something whacked him on the forehead and stuck there. A couple more Ashantis had snuck up on him barefoot. "Sir," one of them said, "I would not recommend operation of your weapon unless you want the round to detonate in your own forehead. Eh?" And he smiled broadly, enormous, perfectly white teeth, and touched his own forehead. Bud reached up and felt something hard glued to the skin of his brow, right over the skull gun. The chev dropped to a trot and cut toward him. Suddenly, Ashantis were everywhere. He wondered how long they'd been tracking him. They all had beautiful smiles. They all carried small devices in their hands, which they aimed at the pavement, trigger fingers laid alongside the barrels until the guy on the chev told them otherwise. Then suddenly, they all seemed to be aimed in his direction. The projectiles stuck to his skin and clothing and burst sideways, flinging out yards and yards of weightless, filmy stuff that stuck to itself and shrank. One struck him in the back of the head, and a swath of the stuff whipped around his face and encased it. It was about as thick as a soap bubble, and so he could see through it pretty well,
It had peeled one of his eyelids back so he couldn't help but see. And everything now had that gorgeous rainbow tinge characteristic of soap bubbles. The entire shrink-wrapping process consumed maybe half a second, and then Bud, mummified in plastic, toppled over, face forward. One of the Ashantis was good enough to catch him. They laid him down on the street and rolled him over on his back. Someone poked the blade of a pocket knife through the film over Bud's mouth so that he could breathe again. Several Ashantis set about the chore of bonding handles to the shrink wrap, two up near the shoulders and two down by the ankles, as the man on the Chev dismounted and knelt over him. This equestrian had several prominent scars on his cheeks. "Sir," the man said, smiling, "I accuse you of violating certain provisions of the Common Economic Protocol, which I will detail at a more convenient time, and I hereby place you under personal arrest. Please be aware that anyone who has been so arrested is subject to deadly force in the event he tries to resist, which, ha-ha, does not seem likely at present, but it is a part of the procedure that I am to say this. As this territory belongs to a nation-state that recognizes the Common Economic Protocol, you are entitled to a hearing of any such charges within the judicial framework of the nation-state in question, which in this case happens to be the Chinese Coastal Republic. This nation-state may or may not grant you additional rights. We will find out in a very few moments when we present the situation to one of the relevant authorities. Ah, I believe I see one now." A constable from the Shanghai police, legs strapped into a pedomotive, was coming down the street with the tremendous loping strides afforded by such devices, escorted by a couple of power-skating Ashantis. The Ashantis had big smiles, but the constable looked stereotypically inscrutable. The chief of the Ashantis bowed to the constable and graciously spun out another lengthy quotation from the fine print of the Common Economic Protocol. The constable kept making a gesture that was somewhere between a nod and a perfunctory bow. Then the constable turned to Bud and said, very fast, "Are you a member of any signatory tribe, file, registered diaspora, franchise-organized quasi-national entity, sovereign polity, or any other form of dynamic security collective claiming status under the CEP?"
"Are you shitting me?" Bud said.
The shrink wrap squished his mouth together so he sounded like a duck. Four Ashantis took the four handles and hoisted Bud off the ground. They began to follow the loping constable in the direction of the causeway that led over the sea to Shanghai.
"How about it?"
Bud quacked through the hole in the shrink wrap.
"You said I might have other rights. Do I have any other rights?"
The constable looked back over his shoulder, turning his head carefully so he wouldn't lose his balance on that pedomotive.
"Don't be a jerk," he said in pretty decent English. "This is China."
Hackworth's Morning Ruminations. Breakfast and Departure for Work. Thinking about tomorrow's crime, John Percival Hackworth slept poorly, rising three times on the pretext of having to use the loo. Each time he looked in on Fiona, who was sprawled out in her white lace nightgown, arms above her head, doing a backflip into the arms of Morpheus. Her face was barely visible in the dark room, like the moon seen through folds of white silk. At 5 a.m., a shrill pentatonic reveille erupted from the North Koreans' brutish mediatrons. Their clave, which went by the name Sendero, was not far above sea level, a mile below the Hackworth's building in altitude, and 20 degrees warmer on the average day. But whenever the women's chorus chimed in with their armor-piercing refrain about the all-seeing beneficence of the serene leader, it felt as if they were right next door. Gwendolyn didn't even stir. She would sleep soundly for another hour, or until Tiffany Sue, her lady's maid, came bustling into the room and began to lay out her clothes. Stretchy lingerie for the morning workout, a business frock, hat, gloves, and veil for later. Hackworth drew a silk dressing gown from the wardrobe and poured it over his shoulders, binding the sash around his waist, the cold tassels splashing over his fingers in the dark. He glanced through the doorway to Gwendolyn's closet and out the other side into her boudoir. Against that room's far windows was the desk she used for social correspondence, really just a table with a top of genuine marble, strewn with bits of stationery, her own and others, dimly identifiable even at this distance as business cards, visiting cards, note cards, invitations from various people still going through triage. Most of the boudoir floor was covered with a tatty carpet, worn through in places all the way down to its underlying matrix of jute, but hand-woven and sculpted by genuine Chinese slave labor during the Mao dynasty. Its only real function was to protect the floor from Gwendolyn's exercise equipment, which gleamed in the dim light scattering off the clouds from Shanghai. A step unit done up in Beaux-Arts ironmongery, a rowing machine cleverly fashioned of writhing sea serpents and hard-bodied nereids, a rack of free weights supported by four Kallipygus caryatids, not chunky Greeks, but modern women, one of each major racial group, each tricep, gluteus, latissimus, sartorius, and rectus abdominis casting its own highlight. Classical architecture indeed. The caryatids were supposed to be role models, and despite subtle racial differences, each body fit the current ideal. 22-inch waist, no more than 17% body fat. That kind of body couldn't be faked with undergarments, never mind what the ads in the women's magazines claimed. The long, tight bodices of the current mode and modern fabrics thinner than soap bubbles made everything obvious. Most women who didn't have superhuman willpower couldn't manage it without the help of a lady's maid, who would run them through two or even three vigorous workouts a day. So after Fiona had stopped breastfeeding, and the time had loomed when Gwen would have to knacker her maternity clothes, they had hired Tiffany Sue. Just another one of the child-related expenses Hackworth had never imagined until the bills had started to come in. Gwen accused him, half-seriously, of having eyes for Tiffany Sue. The accusation was almost a standard formality of modern marriage, as ladies' maids were all young, pretty, and flawlessly buffed. But Tiffany Sue was a typical feat, loud and classless and heavily made up, and Hackworth couldn't abide her. If he had eyes for anyone, it was those caryatids holding up the weight rack. At least they had impeccable taste going for them. Mrs. Hull had not heard him, and was still bumping sleepily around in her quarters. Hackworth put a crumpet into the toaster oven and went out on their flat's tiny balcony with a cup of tea, catching a bit of the auroral breeze off the Yangtze estuary. The Hackworth's building was one of several lining a block-long garden where a few early risers were already out walking their spaniels or touching their toes. Far down the slopes of New Chuzan, the leased territories were coming awake, the senderos streaming out of their barracks and lining up in the streets to chant and sing through their morning calisthenics. All the other thetes, co-arcted into the tacky little claves belonging to their synthetic files, turning up their own mediatrons to drown out the senderos, setting off firecrackers or guns, he could never tell them apart, and a few internal combustion hobbyists starting up their primitive full-lane vehicles, the louder, the better. Commuters lining up at the tube stations, waiting to cross the causeway into Greater Shanghai, seen only as a storm front of neon-stained, coal-scented smog that encompassed the horizon. This neighborhood was derisively called Earshot. But Hackworth didn't mind the noise so much. It would have been a sign of better breeding or higher pretensions to be terribly sensitive about it, to complain of it all the time and to yearn for a townhouse or even a small estate farther inland. Finally, the bells of St. Mark's chimed 6 o'clock. Mrs. Hull burst into the kitchen on the first stroke and expressed shame that Hackworth had beaten her to the kitchen and shock that he had defiled it. The matter compiler in the corner of the kitchen came on automatically and began to create a pedimotive for Hackworth to take to work. Before the last bell had died away, the rhythmic quack, quack, quack of a big vacuum pump could be heard. The engineers of the Royal Vacuum Utility were already at work expanding the eutactic environment. The pumps sounded big, probably intrepids, and Hackworth reckoned that they must be preparing to raise a new structure, possibly a wing of the university. He sat down at the kitchen table. Mrs. Hull was already marmalading his crumpet. As she laid out plates and silver, Hackworth picked up a large sheet of blank paper. "The usual," he said, and then the paper was no longer blank. Now it was the front page of the Times. Hackworth got all the news that was appropriate to his station in life, plus a few optional services, the latest from his favorite cartoonists and columnists around the world, clippings on various peculiar crackpot subjects forwarded to him by his father, ever anxious that he had not, even after all this time, sufficiently edified his son, and stories relating to the Eightlanders, a subfile of New Atlantis consisting of persons of British ancestry who had fled South Africa several decades previously. Hackworth's mother was an Eightlander, so he subscribed to the service. A gentleman of higher rank and more far-reaching responsibilities would probably get different information written in a different way, and the top stratum of New Chuzan actually got the Times on paper, printed out by a big antique press that did a run of 100 or so, every morning at about 3 a.m. That the highest levels of society received news written with ink on paper said much about the steps New Atlantis had taken to distinguish itself from the other files. Now nanotechnology had made nearly anything possible, and so the cultural role in deciding what should be done with it had become far more important than imagining what could be done with it. One of the insights of the Victorian revival was that it was not necessarily a good thing for everyone to read a completely different newspaper in the morning. So the higher one rose in the society, the more similar one's times became to one's peers. Hackworth almost managed to dress without waking Gwendolyn, but she began to stir while he was stringing his watch chain around various tiny buttons and pockets in his waistcoat. In addition to the watch, various other charms dangled from it, such as a snuff box that helped perk him up now and then, and a golden pen that made a little chime whenever he received mail.
"Have a good day at work, dear," she mumbled.
Then, blinking once or twice, frowning and focusing on the chintz canopy over the bed,
"You finish it today, do you?"
"Yes," Hackworth said. "I'll be home late, quite late."
"I understand."
"No," he blurted. Then he pulled himself up short. This was it, he realized.
"Darling?"
"It's not that. The project should finish itself, but after work I believe I'll get a surprise for Fiona. Something special."
"Being home for dinner would be more special than anything you could get her."
"No, darling. This is different. I promise." He kissed her and went to the stand by the front door. Mrs. Hull was awaiting him, holding his hat in one hand and his briefcase in the other. She had already removed the pedomotive from the MC and set it by the door for him. It was smart enough to know that it was indoors, and so its long legs were fully collapsed, giving him almost no mechanical advantage. Hackworth stepped onto the tread plates and felt the straps reach out and hug his legs. He told himself that he could still back out. But a flash of red caught his eye, and he looked in and saw Fiona creeping down the hallway in her nightie, her flaming hair flying all directions, getting ready to surprise Gwendolyn. And the look in her eyes told him that she had heard everything. He blew her a kiss and walked out the door, resolute. Bud is prosecuted. Noteworthy features of the Confucian judicial system. He receives an invitation to take a long walk on a short pier. Bud had spent the last several days living in the open, in a prison on the low, smelly delta of the Changjiang, as most of his thousands of fellow inmates called it, or, as Bud called it, the Yangtze. The walls of the prison were lines of bamboo stakes, spaced at intervals of a few meters, with strips of orange plastic fluttering gaily from their tops. Yet another device had been mounted on Bud's bones, and it knew where those boundaries were. From place to place, one could see a corpse just on the other side of the line, bodies striped with the lurid marks of cookie cutters. Bud had mistaken these for suicides until he'd seen a lynching in progress. A prisoner, who was thought to have stolen some other fellow's shoes, was picked up bodily by the mob, passed from hand to hand overhead like a crowd-surfing rock singer, all the time flailing frantically trying to grab something. When he reached the line of bamboo poles, he was given one last shove and ejected, his body virtually exploding as he flew through the invisible plane of the perimeter. But the ever-present threat of lynching was a minor irritation compared to the mosquitoes. So when Bud heard the voice in his ears telling him to report to the northeast corner of the compound, he didn't waste any time, partly because he wanted to get away from that place and partly because if he didn't, they could pop him by remote control. They could have just told him to walk directly to the courtroom and take a seat, and he would have done it. But for ceremonial purposes, they sent a cop to escort him. The courtroom was a high-ceilinged room in one of the old buildings along the Bund, not lavishly furnished. At one end was a raised platform, and on that was an old folding table with a red cloth tossed over it. The red cloth had gold threads woven through it to make a design, a unicorn or a dragon or some shit like that. Bud had trouble discriminating among mythical beasts. The judge came in and was introduced as Judge Fang by the larger of his two gophers, a bulky, rounded-headed Chinese guy who smelled tantalizingly of menthol cigarettes. The constable who had escorted Bud to the courtroom pointed to the floor, and Bud, knowing his cue, dropped to his knees and touched his forehead to the floor. The judge's other gopher was a tiny little Amerasian woman wearing glasses. Hardly anyone used glasses anymore to correct their vision, and so it was a likely bet that this was actually some kind of phantoscope, which let you see things that weren't there, such as ractives. Although when people used them for purposes other than entertainment, they used a fancier word, phenomenoscope. You could get a phantoscopic system planted directly on your retinas, just as Bud's sound system lived on in his eardrums. You could even get telesthetics patched into your spinal column at various key vertebrae. But this was said to have its drawbacks. some concerns about long-term nerve damage. Plus, it was rumored that hackers for big media companies had figured out a way to get through the defenses that were built into such systems and run junk advertisements in your peripheral vision, or even spang in the fucking middle, all the time, even when your eyes were closed. Bud knew a guy like that who'd somehow gotten infected with a meme that ran advertisements for roach motels in Hindi, superimposed on the bottom right-hand corner of his visual field, 24 hours a day, until the guy whacked himself. Judge Fang was surprisingly young, probably not out of his 30s yet. He sat at the red cloth-covered table and started to talk in Chinese. His two gophers stood behind him. A Sikh was here. He stood up and said a few words back to the judge in Chinese. Bud couldn't figure out why there was a Sikh here, but he'd become accustomed to Sikhs turning up where they were least sought. Judge Fang said in a New York City accent, "The representative from protocol has suggested that we conduct these proceedings in English. Any objections?" Also present was the guy he had mugged, who was holding the one arm rather stiffly but seemed otherwise healthy. His wife was with him, too. "I'm Judge Fang," the judge continued, looking straight at Bud. "You can address me as Your Honor. Now, Bud, Mr. Kwamina here has accused you of certain activities that are illegal in the Coastal Republic. You are also accused of actionable offenses under the Common Economic Protocol, to which we are a subscriber. These offenses are closely related to the crimes I already mentioned, but slightly different. Are you getting all this?"
"Not exactly, Your Honor," Bud said.
"We think you mugged this guy and blew a hole in his arm," Judge Fang said, "which is frowned upon. Capiche?"
"Yes, sir."
Judge Fang nodded at the Sikh, who took the cue.
"The CEP code," said the Sikh, "governs all kinds of economic interactions between people and organizations. Theft is one such interaction. Maiming is another, insofar as it affects the victim's ability to fend for himself economically. As protocol does not aspire to sovereign status, we work in cooperation with the indigenous justice system of CEP signatories in order to pursue such cases."
"You familiar with the Confucian system of justice, Bud?" said Judge Fang. Bud's head was beginning to get dizzy from snapping back and forth like a spectator at a tennis match.
"I'm guessing no." "Okay, even though the Chinese Coastal Republic is no longer strictly or even vaguely Confucian, we still run our judicial system that way. We've had it for a few thousand years, and we think it's not half bad. The general idea is that as judge, I actually perform several roles at once. Detective, judge, jury, and, if need be, executioner."
Bud snickered at this crack, then noticed that Judge Fang did not appear to be in an especially jocose mood. His New Yorkish ways had initially fooled Bud into thinking that Judge Fang was something of a regular guy.
"So, in the first-mentioned role," Judge Fang continued, "I would like for you, Mr. Kwamina, to tell me whether you recognize the suspect."
"He is the man," said Mr. Kwamina, aiming one index finger at Bud's forehead, "who threatened me, shot me, and stole my money."
"And Mrs. Coombe?" Judge Fang said. Then, as an aside to Bud, he added, "In their culture, the woman does not adopt her husband's family name."
Mrs. Coombe just nodded at Bud and said, "He is the guilty party."
"Miss Powell, do you have anything to add?"
The tiny woman in the spectacles looked at Bud and said, in Texan-accented English, "From this man's forehead, I removed a voice-activated nano-projectile launcher, colloquially known as a skull gun, loaded with three types of ammunition, including so-called crippler rounds of the type used against Mr. Kwamina. Nano-presence examination of the serial numbers on those rounds and comparison of the same with fragments removed from Mr. Kwamina's wound indicated that the round used on Mr. Kwamina was fired from the gun embedded in the suspect's forehead."
"Dang," Bud said. "Okay,"
Judge Fang said, and reached up with one hand to rub his temples for just a moment. Then he turned to Bud. "You're guilty."
"Hey, don't I get to put up a defense?" Bud said. "I object."
"Don't be an asshole," Judge Fang said.
The Sikh said, "As the offender has no significant assets, and as the value of his labor would not be sufficient to compensate the victim for his injury, protocol terminates its interest in this case."
"Got it," Judge Fang said.
"Okay, Bud, my man, do you have any dependents?"
"I got a girlfriend," Bud said. "She's got a son named Harv, who is my boy, unless we count her wrong. And I heard she's pregnant."
"You think she is, or you know she is?"
"She was, last time I checked, a couple of months ago."
"What's her name?"
"Tequila."
A muffled snort came from one of the protocol trainees, the young woman, who put one hand over her mouth.
The Sikh appeared to be biting his lip.
Tequila?
Judge Fang said, incredulous. It was becoming clear that Judge Fang tried a lot of these cases and relished the odd scrap of entertainment value. There are 19 women named Tequila in the leased territories, said Miss Powell, reading something out of her phenomenoscope. One of whom delivered a baby girl named Nellody 3 days ago. She also has a 5-year-old boy named Harvard.
Oh, wow,
Bud said.
Congratulations, Bud, you're a paw, Judge Fang said. I gather from your reaction that this comes as something of a surprise. It seems evident that your relationship with this Tequila is tenuous, and so I do not find that there are any mitigating circumstances I should take into account in sentencing. That being the case, I would like you to go out that door over there, Judge Fang pointed to a door in the corner of the courtroom, and all the way down the steps. Leave through the exit door and cross the street, and you will find a pier sticking out into the river. Walk to the end of that pier until you are standing on the red part and await further instructions.
Bud moved tentatively at first, but Judge Fang gestured impatiently, so finally he went out the door and down the stairway and out onto the Bund, the street that ran along the waterfront of the Huang Pu River, and that was lined with big old European-style buildings. A pedestrian tunnel took him under the road to the actual waterfront, which was crowded with Chinese people strolling around and legless wretches dragging themselves hither and thither. Some middle-aged Chinese people had set up a sound system playing archaic music and were ballroom dancing. The music and dance style would have been offensively quaint to Bud at any other point in his life, but now, for some reason, the sight of these somewhat fleshy, settled-looking people twirling around gently in one another's arms made him feel sad. Eventually, he found the right pier. As he strolled out onto it, he had to shoulder his way past some slopes carrying a long bundle wrapped in cloth, who were trying to get onto the pier ahead of him. The view was nice here. The old buildings of the Bund behind him, the vertiginous neon wall of the Pudong Economic Zone exploding from the opposite bank and serving as backdrop for heavy river traffic, mostly chains of low-lying barges. The pier did not turn red until the very end, where it began to slope down steeply toward the river. It had been coated with some kind of grippy stuff so his feet wouldn't fly out from under him. He turned around and looked back up at the domed court building, searching for a window where he might make out the face of Judge Fang or one of his gophers. The family of Chinese was following him down the pier, carrying their long bundle, which was draped with garlands of flowers and, as Bud now realized, was probably the corpse of a family member. He had heard about these piers. They were called funeral piers. Several dozen of the microscopic explosives known as cookie cutters detonated in his bloodstream.
Nell learns to work the matter compiler. Youthful indiscretions. All is made better.
Nell had grown too long for her old crib mattress, and so Harv, her big brother, said he would help get a new one. He was big enough, he offhandedly mentioned, to do that sort of thing. Nell followed him into the kitchen, which housed several important boxy entities with prominent doors. Some were warm, some cool, some had windows, some made noises. Nell had frequently seen Harv or Tequila, or one of Tequila's boyfriends, removing food from them, in one stage or another of doneness. One of the boxes was called the MC. It was built into the wall over the counter. Nell dragged a chair and climbed up to watch as Harv worked at it. The front of the MC was a mediatron, which meant anything that had pictures moving around on it, or sound coming out of it, or both. As Harv poked it with his fingers and spoke to it, little moving pictures danced around. It reminded her of the Ractives she played on the big mediatron in the living room when it wasn't being used by someone bigger.
What are those? Nell said.
Mediaglyphics, Harv said coolly. Someday you'll learn how to read. Nell could already read some of them. Red or blue? Harv asked magnanimously.
Red.
Harv gave it an especially dramatic poke, and then a new mediaglyphic came up, a white circle with a narrow green wedge at the top. The wedge got wider and wider. The MC played a little tune that meant you were supposed to wait. Harv went to the fridge and got himself a juice box, and one for Nell, too. He looked at the MC disdainfully.
This takes so long it's ridiculous, he said. Why?
"'Cause we got a cheap feed. Just a few grams per second. Pathetic.
Why do we got a cheap feed?
Because it's a cheap house.
Why is it a cheap house?
Because that's all we can afford because of the economics, Harv said. Mom's got to compete with all kinds of Chinese and stuff that don't have any self-respect, and so they'll work for nothing.
so Mom's got to work for nothing. He looked at the MC again and shook his head. Pathetic. At the flea circus, they got a feed that's like this big around. He touched his fingertips together in front of him and made a big circle with his arms. But this one's probably like the size of your pinky.
He stepped away from the MC as if he could no longer stand to share a room with it, sucked powerfully on his juice box, and wandered into the living room to get interactive.
Nell just watched the green wedge get bigger and bigger until it filled half the circle, and then it began to look like a green circle with a white wedge in it, getting narrower and narrower, and finally the music came to a bouncy conclusion just as the white wedge vanished.
"It's done," she said.
Harv paused his reactive, swaggered into the kitchen, and poked a media glyphic that was an animated picture of a door swinging open. The MC took to hissing loudly. Harv watched her scared face and ruffled her hair. She could not fend him off because she had her hands over her ears.
"Got to release the vacuum," he explained.
The sound ended, and the door popped open. Inside the MC, folded up neatly, was Nell's new red mattress.
"Give it to me, give it to me,"
Nell shouted, furious to see Harv's hands on it. Harv amused himself for a second playing keep away, then gave it to her. She ran to the room that she shared with Harv and slammed the door as hard as she could. Dinosaur, Duck, Peter, and Purple were waiting for her.
"I got us a new bed," she told them.
She grabbed her old crib mattress and heaved it into the corner, then unfolded the new one precisely on the floor. It was disappointingly thin, more blanket than mattress. But when she had it all laid out on the floor, it made a whooshing noise, not loud, the sound of her brother's breathing late at night. It thickened as it inhaled, and when it was done, it looked like a real mattress. She gathered Dinosaur and Duck and Peter and Purple up into her arms, and then, just to make sure, jumped up and down on it several hundred times.
"You like it?" Harv said.
He had opened the door.
"No, get out!"
Nell screamed.
"Nell, it's my room, too," Harv said. "I gotta deke your old one."
Later, Harv went out with his buddies, and Nell was alone in the house for a while. She decided that her kids needed mattresses, too, and so she dragged the chair to the counter and climbed up on top, right in front of the MC, and tried to read the media glyphics. A lot of them she didn't recognize, but she remembered that Tequila just used words when she couldn't read something, so she tried talking to it instead.
"Please secure the permission of an adult," the MC said, over and over again.
Now she knew why Harv always poked at things rather than talking to them. She poked at the MC for a long time until finally she came to the same media glyphics that Harv had used to choose her mattress. One showed a man and a woman sleeping in a very large bed. A man and a woman in a somewhat smaller bed. A man by himself. A child by herself. A baby. Nell poked at the baby. The white circle and red wedge appeared, the music played, the MC hissed and opened. She spread it out on the floor and formally presented it to Dinosaur, who was too little to know how to jump up and down on it. So Nell showed him for a while. Then she went back to the MC and got mattresses for Duck, Peter, and Purple. Now, much of the room was covered with mattresses, and she thought how fun it would be to have the whole room just be one big mattress, so she made a couple of the very largest size. Then she made a new mattress for Tequila and another new one for her boyfriend Raj. When Harv came back, his reaction swerved between terror and awe.
"Mom's gonna have Raj beat the shit out of us," he said. "We gotta deke all this stuff now."
"Easy come, easy go." Nell explained the situation to her kids, and then helped Harv stuff all of the mattresses, except her own, into the deke hopper. Harv had to use all his strength to shove the door closed.
"Now we'd just better hope this stuff all deeks before Mom gets home," he said. "It's gonna take a while."
Later, they went to bed, and both lay awake for a while, dreading the sound of the front door opening. But neither Mom nor Raj came home that night. Mom finally showed up in the morning, changed into her maid outfit, and ran for the bus to the Vicky Clave, but she just left all her garbage on the floor instead of throwing it in the hopper. When Harv checked the hopper later, it was empty.
"We dodged a bullet," he said. "You gotta be careful how you use the matter compiler, Nell."
"What's a matter compiler?"
"We call it the MC for short."
"Why?"
"Because MC stands for matter compiler, or so they say."
"Why?"
"It just does. In letters, I guess."
"What are letters?"
"Kind of like media glyphics, except they're all black and they're tiny, and they don't move. They're old and boring and really hard to read. But you can use them to make short words for long words."